So rise up, sisters, we need each other to demand equality. The song No Thanks, Mister is one of the tracks from one of the very first out-of-the-closet lesbian bands of the 70s, the Berkeley Women's Music Collective. This is J.D. Doyle bringing you part 3 of my show on lesbian feminist bands of the 70s. And the Berkeley band is one I just had to cover. Over its 6-year career, the band had 6 different members, with the main group being Nancy Vogel, Debbie Lemke, Suzanne Chambon, and Nancy Henderson. An early member, Jake Lampert, left to be in the band B.B. K. Roach, and around the time of the recording of their first album, in late 1975, Nancy Henderson left and was replaced by Bonnie Lockhart. They toured the country extensively and released 2 albums, a self-titled one in 76 and Trying to Survive in 1978. And their music was full of feminist and lesbian politics, as you might know by their anthem, Gay and Proud. But you'll hear more about that later. That's the nutshell version, but I'm delighted to go into more detail with a special interview with Nancy Vogel. Naturally, my first question was how the Berkeley Women's Music Collective got started.
Well, what seemed to be occurring were hot pockets of cities where women were gravitating to certain key hot pockets. Iowa City, believe it or not, was a hotbed of radical feminism in the late 60s, and Boston, of course. And so Berkeley was, you know, starting to generate some kind of scene for the 70s. And so Debbie Lemke moved down from Oregon, where she was living, and put up a notice at the local food co-op. And I moved into what was called Derby Dyke House. And so there were 13 women living in the old governor's mansion in Berkeley. And so it was, you know, this kind of rotating dyke house, and we lived collectively. So I moved there, and Debbie put up her sign in the co-op, and then Nancy Henderson, who saw the sign, 2 weeks later we had a meeting at Derby Dyke House, and so the four of us just started a band, and then Suzanne Chambon moved down from Oregon, and then we needed a bass player, because that's how people played bass in those days, you know. Oh, everybody played guitar, but, you know, we always needed a bass player, so Suzanne played bass. And that was it. And so she put up the sign 2 weeks later, and then we started practicing.
Do you know what year this was?
Yeah, let's see. That was, it would be November of 73.
So did the band live together?
Just 2 of us. Nancy was in Derby Dyke House, and I was there. Everyone else lived in Berkeley.
Okay. I was wondering how literal the word collective was for the band.
Oh, we took that word because collectives were the new iconic symbol of a new world. So there was the press collective, the print collective, the food collective. Everybody was doing collectives. So, you know, we just took that model.
I love that on the back cover of your first album, it starts out, "We are lesbians."
Well, at that time, we wanted to be as radical as possible.
You were probably the most out early lesbian band.
We were the maddest, I think.
The angriest.
Yeah. You know, I had grown up my whole life never practically hearing the word lesbian. And when I did, I remember I looked it up in an old psychology book, and there was this woman who looked like she'd been strung out on heroin for 30 years, was smoking a cigar, wearing a, you know, an old suit and a tie, and she just looked like a decrepit, I don't know. So we thought, well, if that's the only image people have, well, you know, we have to blow it up.
Right, right. Let people know there are other images to look at.
Absolutely, yeah.
So how did the music gel with the band?
Well, we were all songwriters because at that time, women in music had certain role models. I mean, Joni Mitchell came out in the late 60s, Judy Collins, a lot of us listened to jazz. So we just brought whatever we had listened to, and then we all had a pile of songs that we had written in our teens and early, you know, late teens. And we were all 22, 23 at the time when we all met. So we each had a storehouse of about 10 songs, and we just threw them all together and then arranged them. But Nancy Henderson was the only one who knew how to read music. They joke about everything's process in early lesbian days is because we didn't have the tools. We didn't have any tools to work with. So it all had to be from feeling. So we would say, well, go from, you know where it goes, dut, dut? Go add one more dut, dut, dut there. And it was excruciating. You know, it was just excruciating. Well, where do you mean? Well, you know, no, not at the end of the chorus, right at the end of the verse. And so half of our time was taken up with this ridiculous effort to try to communicate. And so then in 76, Suzanne and Debbie enrolled in Berklee School of Music. And so they went back to Boston during the school year, and then we would come play music during the summer. So then they learned a lot of music tools, of course, because they learned the language.
Talk about Suzanne's song, Trying to Survive.
Yeah, so there's Suzanne in L.A. sticking out like a sore thumb and wanting to come out. And at that time, you know, it's 60, she was in high school, so that would have been 67. You know, that just wasn't done. You know what I mean? And so she had a lot of baggage. So that's why she wrote Thorazine and Trying to Survive, is that it was just almost impossible to be who you wanted to be in a context where you were, you know, vilified and shouldn't exist. Basically, the message was you shouldn't exist. And I think that's, you know, Trying to Survive was, again, an expression of the personal is political.
Some women walk the walk. Some women learn to crawl. Some women try not to be here at all. Some women learn to cook. Some women learn to hook. Some women learn to type. We learn to snipe. Oh, yeah. And we're trying to survive, trying to survive. Trying, trying to survive, trying to survive. Trying, whoa. Survive, trying to survive, trying, trying to survive, trying to survive, trying, oh, who do you think you are, what did they tell you, who do you think you are, what did they say, who do you think you are, what did they tell you, who do you think you are, what did they say, some women chart the stars, some women go off to bars. Some women organize to stop the lies. Yeah. Some women raising sons. Some women shooting guns. Some women cry at night. We learn to fight. Oh, yeah. And we're trying to survive, trying to survive. Trying, trying to survive, trying to survive. Trying, whoa. Survive, trying to survive, trying, trying to survive, trying to survive, trying, whoa, whoa. Who do you think you are? What did they tell you? Who do you think you are? What did they say? Who do you think you are? What did they tell you? Who do you think you are? What did they say?
I read an article that Suzanne wrote, and it was in Paid My Dues in like 79, and it's interesting because she didn't talk about the music. She talked instead about the business end and the mechanics of the band and how the work was split up, and that must have been, there must have been some challenging aspects to all that.
We didn't know anything. We didn't know how to do anything. We made everything up. So I kind of used to do art. I was a hippie type, so I did t-shirts and the graphics, and Suzanne actually had been trained as the first woman Xerox repair person in, I think, the West Coast, and she ran around Berklee, you know, fixing all the Xerox machines, so she was, you know, technically oriented, so she started doing sound, and so we would just divide up our roles based on what we had a proclivity for, what we enjoyed, and then you became the boss of that.
How did you figure out whose songs got performed or included in the albums?
You know, it was pretty much doing our sets, we would divide it equally. So each of us got two songs per set. And then we would just, through a lot of agony, really, what we learned is that if everybody throws out what they want on the table, then you negotiate about getting your wants and needs met. Rather than not saying what you want and then having it come up in some bizarre, non-related way later. So what we learned to do is to say, look, I think these songs are the two best. I'm going to fight to the death. And if I don't win, then I'll just be a good sport and move on.
Well, I figured it was had to be pretty democratic because I did the math with the writer's credits. And on both albums, they were split almost exactly evenly.
Oh, really? That didn't come out like consciously. We just made it happen, I suppose.
Other than the slightly different personnel, what were the main differences between the two albums? I mean, music styles or overall messages?
Well, I think the messages were pretty much the same because we kind of embodied the lesbian, feminist, socialist, you know, separatism was a big deal then. And whether it was a political ideological separatism or it was just how we happened to roll in our personal lives, you know, all my friends were lesbians. I hung out with lesbians and I just didn't know many men who, you know, could be comfortable in that scene. We saw power dynamics and the corruption of power. So a big part of the band was really deconstructing power in terms of who had it, how they got it, and what they did with it. And those were the three things that I think embodied a kind of a wing of lesbian culture.
I'm curious, the two albums were distributed by Olivia but were not on the label. What were the factors involved with that? And did you just want to be on your own label? Or?
No, Olivia at the time had their own, stable or I don't know, you know, artist.
Yeah.
Thing. And they had their own collective. They were a collective and they had their own artists. And yet, on the other hand, here they had a national distribution network because of the artists and because they were in business. So it seemed reasonable to just piggyback on what they had already created. But we weren't Olivia artists in the way that they would provide tour support, backing, booking, and all that. So we were on our own, but they just decided to distribute it because it made sense.
Right, more of a business decision.
Yeah, and the way that Redwood Records started distributing a lot, because they, again, had the infrastructure.
Was it common in the 70s for women musicians to perform songs by other musicians, you know, like at the festivals?
Well, you know, not as much because we were all such frustrated singer-songwriters. I mean, that was pretty much the idea of the genre, is that you would bring your own stuff to the table and express your guts out from your own personal experience. But some songs became really popular, and so if you didn't have enough material or, you know, you wanted to cover somebody else's tunes. But, I mean, for the most part, I think it was our own stuff.
What prompted that question was, I believe the Clinch Mountain Backsteppers were singing The Bloods before it was actually on your album.
Well, right, because Mary Wings and Debbie Lemke were together up in Portland. So Debbie was playing the banjo and Mary, and that's where Debbie wrote The Bloods. So then Debbie and Mary broke up, and then Deb moved down to Berkeley. So then Mary still knew the tune, and then Mary and Robin started playing together with Woody Simmons.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were all friends. That's why the commingling of material.
And here's a very rare recording from the 1974 National Women's Music Festival of Robin Flower, Woody Simmons, and Mary Wings, a.k.a. the Clinch Mountain Backsteppers, singing live The Bloods.
When the moon is full, I feel my uterus, and I know the time is coming soon. Some sisters get down on menstruation, but this ain't no time for sad desperation. There's a new day coming. got the blood to him.
Because you know your body isn't working all right. If you had self-help, you could watch all night. Get your speculum at your neighborhood clinic. Learn about your cervix and what's in it. There's a new day dawn when you got the bloods again.
Well, men keep saying bloods are bad. Me and Jane, Colonel, and it ain't been had. I know the time is coming, coming soon. A man will stop saying got to sleep with women, plus a lesbian. They got natural rhythm. There's a new day coming when you got the bloods again.
Because you know your body isn't working all right. If you had self-help, you could watch all night. Get your speculum at your neighborhood clinic. Learn about your cervix and what's in it. There's a new day coming when you got the bloods again.
If you're feeling bad, don't you start to moan. Don't you run and hide, you're not alone. Know the time's coming, come soon. If you're living together, this I found. When the bloods come, they come all the way around. There's a new day coming, you got the bloods.
Because you know your body isn't working all right. If you had self-help, you could watch all night. Get your speculum at your neighborhood clinic. Learn about your cervix and what's in it. If the new day comes, when you got the bloods again.
Clinch Mountain Backsteppers, and I also asked Nancy about that song.
Well, Debbie was a little ahead of us, you know, and was writing this material, and I think she felt it, as I say, all of our songs were an expression of our personal experience because, you know, the personal is political, right? That was such a big part of the movement when we were finding each other. And so Debbie was pretty butch and frankly, not classically, attractive in the dominant cultural iconic look for a young woman. And so she stood out more and she felt it more. And she got a lot of shit when she was a kid and she was a tomboy that she didn't outgrow. You know, her self-expression, her survival had to come out, and she came out in her music sooner than us. I could pass a little bit more. I mean, I was certainly angry, but I didn't experience the vilification that she did. So my political music came later. But hers was a personal, real personal expression. So Gay and Proud, she wrote, and the Bloods, you know, for her, was just her own view of the world coming out.
So let's hear the same song by the Berkeley Band from their 1976 LP.
Get down for menstruation. Ain't no time for sad desperation. There's a new day coming when you got the bloods again. Because you know your body isn't working all right. If you had self-help, you can watch all night. Get your speculum at your neighborhood clinic. Learn about your cervix and what's in it. There's a new day coming when you got the bloods again. If you're feeling bad and you start to moan, well, don't you hide, you're not alone. I know a time a coming soon. When you're living together, this I found. When the bloods come all the way around. There's a new day coming when you got the bloods again. Because you know your body isn't working all right. If you had self-help, you could watch all night. Get your speculum at your neighborhood clinic. Learn about your cervix and what's in it. There's a new day coming when you got the bloods again. Thank you.
means you ain't fertile, that you ain't been had. I know time a coming soon. Men stop saying gotta sleep with plus lesbians. They got natural rhythm as a new day come when you got the blood to give. Because you know your body isn't working alright. If you had self-help, you could watch all night. Get your speculum at your neighborhood clinic. Learn about your cervix and what's in it. There's a new day come when you got the blood to give.
Well, Suzanne wrote Fury.
Yep, uh-huh. We were all, you know, in Berkeley, so there was a lot going on. We could see the inequalities around us, and Suzanne's class background gave her a lot of hostility towards, you know, middle and upper class. All of our experiences we all threw together. So class, not so much ethnicity, but, you know, Suzanne and Debbie are Jewish, so culturally we had some struggles around that. It was an educational time to throw everything in together.
Well, there is peace in my heart when I stop, knowing I stop. Well, there is peace in my heart. Well, there is peace in my heart when I start, knowing I start. But you know that the fury, you know the fury, it comes over me. Money, hope and air, save
songs were full of politics. Here's a sweet one Nancy wrote for the second album, called Back to Boston.
Considering the lifespan of many bands, this one lasted a while. Why did it end?
Let's see. Why did it end?
And when?
It was 79. We played Michigan. So we were together from 73 to 79. I think Suzanne and Debbie, after going to school in Boston, they really wanted to move back east. Debbie was from New York and wanted and loved the East Coast feel. And so she wanted to move back to Boston for a while. And then Suzanne loved being back east, and so she wanted to move there. And it just got too hard to do a bi-coastal band.
Right.
So, and I think maybe we thought maybe we had said everything that we wanted to say right then in that configuration. And I was starting on my off times to play with Robin Flower. So Robin and I were starting to think about touring together. So we did that. So I think it's time. 6 years was plenty.
Yeah, that's a good amount. What do you think the legacy is of the Berkeley Women's Music Collective?
You got me. You know, everything's in a context, right? So not to be revisionist, you have to think, what were we in a movement and an awakening of what women had never experienced? And so what we saw was we were a band. We were trying to work collectively. We were trying to counter sort of the individual idolization that we saw from the dominant culture. But you can't take people out of a dominant culture and stick them into a subculture without having lots of trappings of what came before. So for us, this is an awkward question because it was really so much projection, so that we would go to these concerts and the woman on the stage embodied everything that we wanted to be or say. And so women began to live out their lives through the fantasies of the artists that they saw. And so it was much easier to throw your heart into Meg Christian, Teresa Troll, Chris Williamson, Trett Furey, you know, these individual women. And so what we saw in our own experience was that it was challenging for a women's audience to embrace a band in the same way that they embraced a solo performer.
Hmm.
Because there was a certain amount of projection and fantasy going on. And I don't say that with a pejorative attitude. I'm just saying that's what was going on. The big book that hasn't been written and the big movie that hasn't been created is what it was like to be in a band in the early women's movement when one performer would get paid three times what the band was getting paid. And so we would divide it amongst four musicians and a sound woman, and yet we would get one third of the salary of the solo performer who was there the week before. So, and I'm not saying this in a bitter way. I'm just saying if you look at the way reality was, that was the way kind of the movement broke down. And so it was challenging for us. It was a part of the frustration.
Well, you were one of the first openly lesbian bands.
Absolutely.
Like Mountain Moving Day, they weren't openly lesbian or even all lesbian.
Well, at this point for us, it was like, give it a break. We were all wearing, you know, motorcycle boots and flannel shirts. No one's going to take us for Mary Tyler Moore.
Did your band perform Bonnie's song, Still Ain't Satisfied?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, that's a classic.
But you never recorded it. That's too bad.
Didn't record it. Robin Flower recorded it on her, I think, second album.
Well, I do have a live recording of the song to share with you by the band, as done in 1976 at the National Women's Music Festival.
Well, they got women on TV, but I still ain't satisfied. 'Cause co-optation is all I see, and I still ain't satisfied. They call me Miss, they sell me blue jeans, call it women's lib. They make it sound obscene, but I still ain't. Now they got women prison guards, and I still ain't satisfied. With so many still behind bars, I still ain't satisfied. I don't plead guilt, don't want no bomb deal. All I want the crumbs, I want the whole meal, and still ain't for their lives. Still ain't for their lives. Still ain't for their lives, and I still ain't satisfied. Yes, they've liberalized abortion, and I still ain't satisfied. 'Cause it still costs a fortune, and I still ain't satisfied. I'm talking about control of my own womb, and no reform gonna change my tune. 'Cause it still ain't for their lives. Still ain't for their lives. Still ain't for their lives, and I still ain't satisfied. Now they hand out money here and there, but I still ain't satisfied. To set up centers for child care, I still ain't satisfied. To make us work every day for slave wages, and brainwash our kids at tender ages. And I still ain't for their lives. For their lives. Still ain't for their lives. I still ain't satisfied. I got my pride, I won't be lied to. I did decide, halfway just won't do. And I still ain't for their lives. For their lives. For their lives. And I still ain't satisfied.
I've got another live recording treat, and this time it was from the 1979 National Women's Music Festival. The song was not on their albums, although it did show up later as an instrumental on Nancy's first solo album. She wrote it, and there's lots of fine guitar work on this one. It's called Do You Remember?
And from across the country, the Berkeley Women's Music Collective.
Thank you. You can give your heart away, but beware. Do you know what's going on inside her head? If you think you're knowing, well, try again. And do you remember that love can be cruel? Fill you with lies. Sneak round the back door and slip in a surprise. Do you know what's going on? Make it slow. Old habits growing way out of control. Ho, ho, ho.
I sent Nancy an MP3 of that song, and she wrote me back that she was floored. She said she had not thought about that song in 30 years and didn't even remember ever performing it.
From the second album, you had a song called Darling Companion.
Yeah, just total personal expression. You know, I was looking at our lives as young women and the role models that we had as our mothers and how they were just, you know, diametrically opposed to what the expectations were of what our lives would be. I grew up in a very, very, very sexist household, and I was pretty critical of my mother, although, you know, again, it just shows my intolerance and my attempt to decide that my mother should think what I think. But, you know, it was certainly my expression at the time, this whole idea that we were preordained. I was going to grow up and marry a second lieutenant. That was what my childhood fantasy was, you know, up until, I don't know, I was 10 or something. And I wouldn't have to think about anything because my husband would do everything for me, because that's the way my parents were.
My father was a soldier. My mother was his wife. She left a life on the stage to do what she thought right. She was a baby, they took her by the hand and said to be a woman, darling, you must love a man. And they said to be a woman, you must love a man. And so they raised a family, three young boys and finally a daughter and a sister for them all. Me by the hand, and I learned to be a woman, I must love a man. And I learned to be a woman, I must love a man. And I cried lady that I knew that I should be. But now that I am older and I can understand the sweetness of the secrets they've denied, oh my darling companion, how you can satisfy, oh, can't you hear me cry every time I think of how they lie? I can feel the fire raging and there's no disguise, oh my.
I want to insert a bit of bio info for Nancy Vogel. After being in the Berkeley Band, she toured extensively, mostly with Suzanne Shambaum and Robin Flower. She played on a number of albums by other artists like Woody Simmons, Trish Nugent, Holly Near, and others. She released two solo albums, Something to Go On in 1984 on Redwood Records and Flight of the Dancer in 1986 on Olivia. I asked her to talk just a moment about her Something to Go On album.
Well, I guess Something to Go On, the whole second side, those are guitar duets that Suzanne and I did together. And I think what makes that unique is that to this day, I don't think that I have heard two women playing guitar doing duets that are like that. I mean, Suzanne and I fit together musically just unbelievably. We've known each other since we were 23. I'm 61. Her lines are just these delicate, both delicate and powerful, and what I do is set a pretty sophisticated rhythm, and she just takes off across the top. That album, The Second Side, those, I guess, are the pinnacle of my guitar playing, for the most part, I'd say. And I think that album, The Second Side, I'm just super proud of.
And then she began her career in youth counseling. And that's what she wanted to talk about when I asked her near the end of our interview if there was anything I had not asked her yet, but I should ask.
Well, anything just the last is to just say that I work with young people today. I run a gay and lesbian and bisexual transgender youth group, and I also work in another job. I work with kids on probation in the juvenile justice system. And I can only say to all your listeners that one of the things we say in Positive Images, which is the youth group here, is that so many of us didn't have children, our own. But I can only leave this with your audience that anybody who lived through the 70s and is an active senior now, there is so much to contribute to today's youth and to share the history that we had, not like we know everything, but just give them a sense of continuity, mentoring, and getting out there and working with young people.
And I was also glad she remembered to update us on her old band.
Okay, I just want to make sure I've talked about all my bandmates as much. You know, Suzanne is still playing music. Oh, one more thing, yeah. Suzanne and I play in a band called Pokonomics.
I have your CD.
Oh, you do?
Yep.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, so Suzanne's still playing, and we play out here in Northern California and just have fun. It's a blast. And Debbie has a music store back in Boston, Wood and Strings Music Shop. So if anybody goes to Boston, check her out. Yeah, Suzanne, Debbie. And then Nancy Henderson teaches special ed in Berkeley. And Bonnie Lockhart is still playing music and is pretty big in the Occupy Oakland movement.
Right. She has a version of Still Ain't Satisfied on YouTube with different lyrics.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah, Bonnie's always out there.
In the 70s, you were right in the middle of women's music history, and you worked with cream of the crop, Holly Near, Robin Flower, Woody Simmons, Barbara Higbee. There has to be almost no words to describe all that, but could you try?
Well, I think in other times in history where you have a confluence, some mercurial, indescribable confluence of historical context plus personalities. I mean, the only thing I can describe it as is the way they talk about Paris in the 20s, where you had people who were starving intellectually or artistically had to come together, really, and again, I guess it comes down to survival, is that there's something so stultifying about the dominant culture that you have to find each other to remind each other that there's another way of being and or expressing or being alive or something. And so that's what I felt like was happening. Women were beginning to look dialectically at the dominant culture, the stereotyping, the image that we were supposed to be, and yet none of us felt. Growing up in an expanding 1950s and 60s economy, we had more privilege. We had, to many, many of us, had more privilege. We had more education. And suddenly the expectations no longer suited who we were. And so it was an exciting, invigorating, absolutely heady experience, because instead of saying, okay, your life is this, do this, it was, what we said to each other is, what's your life and what are you going to do about it? That's like turning life upside down on its head from what we knew. And so from town to town, we were meeting, you know, the most creative, the most independent, the most exciting, the most sort of the most alive women in all the towns were all getting together and making things happen. And that, yes, you're right. It was just an absolutely exciting time to be alive, and really kept us, you know, waking up every day.
Is there a song by the band of which you're the most proud?
Well, that's a good question. You know, our anthem, really, I mean, to say that we recorded this song, I guess we did our first album in what, I think it was 70, we recorded in 75, I think it came out in 76. So, I mean, I suppose at that time, the fact that we had written a song, Gay and Proud, that Debbie wrote, I mean, I suppose that says a lot about who we were.
Would you want to expand on Gay and Proud any?
Well, just the title alone speaks volumes for where the movement was at the time, because it was before lesbians had split off. Gay meant what it means now if you're not really aware that gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, I mean, it was the gay movement. And
right.
So that's why she wrote Gay and Proud. So that speaks volumes about where we were as a movement, because then, from then on, we were lesbians, right? We would never write Gay and Proud. I think our being willing to shout it out gave permission for other women and other people to shout it out.
I was born a bastard, you know my mother well, she couldn't keep me, sent me off to a foster home, where they try to teach me that girls can't go climbing trees or playing with certain toys.
Down from that tree.
Got to stay in dresses, else they call
tomboy.
I sing it loud. Couldn't understand why I cut my hair short. Why didn't it want to wear pink? But I could sing it loud now. I could sing it loud now. I could sing it loud now. Yeah, I'm proud. As I grew bolder, got to be a desperate situation. People coming up to me at school say, hey,
you ought to get an operation.
Oh, I can sing it loud now. Oh, I can sing it loud now. Oh, I can sing it loud now. Yeah, I'm proud.
Thank you.
try to bring me out. Had to hide when they cry. Homosexual, we could sing it loud now. Heavy duty pup.